This is Johnny Bluestar. Welcome to Threshold, a global media event. Is the universe just a random dance of atoms? Or is it a manifestation of a supremely intelligent architect? Can its purpose, or our purpose here on Earth, be adequately assessed? Can we commune with it, know its intentions, cooperate with its direction? Here, we define Threshold as a gateway state of awareness, allowing mankind to cross into a place of real cognition. Threshold allows us to approach questions of higher reality through the door of experience rather than mere belief. Welcome to Threshold, where we tear away the veil from commercial media, bringing our audience and participants into another realm of reality and enhanced communication. We're back on Threshold. Ken Eid is joining me on this session. We're going to be looking at the Bill of Rights. This is a really critical, foundational element in what I would call American culture and the American dream, because this embodies some of the very specific rights that we are entitled to by the Constitution and that we depend on. That in fact, we use these amendments in part to define our concept of freedom and liberty. So I'm going to go over these with Ken, and I'm going to ask him, as an attorney and as an advocate for liberty, what his opinion is of their status right now, and we'll discuss it a little bit. So the First Amendment says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or of the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Now that's actually a lot of little critical things all in one amendment, isn't it? Just one sentence.
Right.
So let's start here. Do we feel that there are challenges regarding the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof? I think it's a poignant thing to discuss.
Well, and with regard to the latest controversy over Islam, probably.
And we're talking about the ban on the proposed ban by Donald Trump on Islamic people coming to this country at all.
Right, and there's also a recent House bill that was passed that required visas for people from certain Islamic countries who didn't need it before.
Right. Now, the question is, in regards to these particular components of religion, does this really refer to people who are not American citizens? In other words, if we're banning people who are not American citizens, is that under the First Amendment?
It doesn't apply to anyone who's not physically in the United States. That's the interpretation of the court of all of the Bill of Rights.
Okay.
It only applies to U.S. citizens wherever they are, or people who are in the United States of whatever citizenship. So once they find themselves on our soil, then the freedom of religion applies. But if it's a foreign resident in a foreign land, it does not.
Well,
if you were perhaps on a U.S. territory or embassy or something like that.
But then it would apply.
Yes.
Well, what about this? I was wondering if there was any kind of in this proposed ban by Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. What about American citizens who are Muslims who are abroad? Are they going to not let them come back?
No, that wouldn't apply to them.
Well, that is really generous of him, isn't it?
Well, yes, we're talking about
maybe the sensitivity of a human right. But it doesn't really specifically apply in this case to this ban, right?
No, it doesn't. But you know, we're talking about freedom of religion as one of the Bill of Rights, one of the First Amendment civil rights. It's actually a human right as well. It's recognized in the Western world, and often the countries that we talk about being in the Western world, such as European countries, they follow these ideals like we do. Well, like we should. So it's always been, the Bill of Rights has always been an inspiration to them for their own, for their own civil rights.
Well, I think that, when they talk about sort of their inalienable rights, and among yes. those are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it certainly implied that there are non-enumerated rights, human rights that are, that I think we're expanding the concept of the American dream to encompass, and sometimes these things have been expanded in people's minds for quite some time.
They have, and when you're talking life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, that's the mantra of the American dream. And you really can't have all that unless you have these guarantees. It's basically, these are not, the Bill of Rights are not rights that were granted to us by the government. They're guarantees that the government's not going to step on the rights that we already have as human beings.
Right, inalienable rights.
Right, that's what the court has always, that's what the Supreme Court has always said about the Bill of Rights. It's just guaranteeing us that they're not going to screw with what we already have.
Right. Well, another part of it is abridging the freedom of speech of the press. And I think we've already begun to touch on this.
Yes.
What's going on now is a very serious affront to both of these things.
Mm-hmm.
I think particularly of the Occupy movement, which I may have mentioned, but here you have, I think, 5,000 or more people arrested for abridging the freedom of speech, and yet the kind of problems that they were particularly tackling, which was, I think, cornerstone of it was corporate corruption of various types, seems to me to that nobody was arrested for the egregious things that happened during 2008. And yet,
that's ironic, isn't it? But the freedom of what you're talking about is kind of scary because freedom of assembly and freedom of speech, they go right along hand in hand.
Exactly.
But the Citizens United decision said that a corporation has no right to publish certain things, and this. Many, many, many political organizations incorporate, or they have an unincorporated association. This is a very dangerous decision with regard to freedom of speech, freedom of publication, freedom of assembly. It goes against the grain of all the Supreme Court decisions for the past 200 years. So we also see this war on terror and everyone's terrified in the United States that there's going to be a terrorist attack, and the state is taking this opportunity to beef up the police force and basically make them into a paramilitary force. And you're going to see this effect on freedom of assembly as well. Too many people get together and they're causing too much of a problem. That could be a safety issue, and you'll see tear gas and riot gear, and we're seeing that already to a certain degree.
Well, and as we were saying, these two, one way you abridge freedom of speech is by not allowing people to assemble.
Exactly.
And that seems to me that was pretty obvious, as diluted a ideology as the occupation movement had. Mm-hmm. You would think that there was not that much to be afraid of, but they were assembling and they were making protests against the established order.
Yes. And that's what the whole thing is designed for us to be able to do. In the American colonies before the United States came into existence, this was a problem, speaking out against the king, speaking out against the establishment. That's something that people couldn't do.
Well, another thing, which I wonder what you think of in terms of this, petitioning the government for a redress of grievances, don't you think whistleblower laws are kind of part of that component or not?
I think whistleblower laws are unconstitutional, absolutely. Part of the idea of a government that is by the people is a transparent government. And we don't have a transparent government.
Well, anymore. I was talking about the laws that allow whistleblowers to come forward.
Oh, the laws that allow whistleblowers to come forward
isn't that sort of part of the and it is expressing the right of petitioning the government for a redress of grievances. Do you think it falls under that?
It probably falls under that, but it more falls under the Fourth Amendment's right of privacy and the transparency of government. We had this never became an issue until Edward Snowden alerted everyone to the fact that the government was actually spying on us, and he's probably the most famous whistleblower in the world.
Well, there was at least one or more people, like Drake is an example, mm-hmm. who blew the whistle on NSA for the mm-hmm. secret spying. His was fairly a large profile case, but nothing like Snowden.
And Chelsea Manning,
right? Mm-hmm. So you have and then of course we should talk about the surveillance of the press.
Yeah, I mean, we're exercising freedom of the press right now, aren't we?
We are, and I think in a very positive way. But there have been some pretty heavy surveillance over reporters, and then
there has, and I'm actually working on a book right now called The Spy Files, which is about it's a series in my legal thriller series, and it's about a lawyer who advocates a case for a journalist who's trying to get documents pursuant to the Freedom of Information Act, and he's put on one of these watch lists and labeled as a subversive, which is another one of these things that we talked about last time, is that the United States is surveilling all of our private information and putting people on a watch list, and we don't even know about this.
Yeah, that's certainly not what I ever expected when I grew up thinking 1984 was science fiction.
Well, it's not. Big Brother's alive and well. And now instead of coming to us through the television, he's coming to us through the internet.
Yeah.
Which, there's already a means to capture all of your data, which should be private. And commercial enterprises like Google capture your data all the time. And by using their service, you're supposed to be agreeing to them being able to violate your privacy. But there's no box that you check that says, I agree to that you violate my privacy. It's just when you go in and use Google, then basically they're data mining everything you've got.
Right.
All your internet surfing history, everything. And then the government gets in there. The FBI, one of their main functions is to bust people who are looking at pornography. It's child pornography, which I don't condone. But being able to do that means you've got to look at what people are looking at. And that's what they do. They troll the internet and they look for these creepy guys who are looking for child porn. But they're going to use the same technique for everything else. I mean, that's the way the government works.
Right. Well, we're going to take a break right now, and we'll come back, and we're going to be going into more detail on the Bill of Rights.
Boots in Manhattan is a coming-of-age novel by Ray Boylan and Johnny Bluestar. It is about a young Tom Boots Raymond who grows up in New York in the 1940s, who is a member of a street gang.
My friends and I were about to start our own game of stickball when Rabbit Lacey, the head of the Rattlers, came up to us and tried to move in on our game. We were called dwarves, the youngest members of this stupid gang.
Hey, Kevin, I need you to get some gloves and some stuff I left at my place.
No, this is our game.
Hey, are you my good little dwarf or what?
You've been calling me a dwarf since I was 6. We're not your personal slaves, pal.
Hey, what is this? A dwarf rebellion? All right, big guy. We ditched the dwarf thing. We make you guys regular rattlers.
No, it's too late.
He looked at Jay and me. We looked away. Rabbit was now angry, and he pushed Kevin hard with the palms of his hand. Kevin tried to ram him in the stomach, but he stepped aside, throwing Kevin into the curb where he fell to the ground, bleeding profusely at the knee. Still, he managed to get up.
My street.
Kevin shouted at Rabbit, pointing at him with an angry index finger.
Find out more by Googling Boots in Manhattan, a 1940s coming-of-age novel, part one of the novel series The Foot Soldier by Ray Boylan and Johnny Bluestar. Google with the words Boots in Manhattan, Ray Johnny Kendall. That's Boots in Manhattan, Ray Johnny Kendall.
Nowadays, if you are a serious business person, just getting assistance from someone with a license and a bit of experience may not be sufficient. In fact, your realtor actually needs to be knowledgeable enough to be one of your top advisors. Whether you are facilitating a giant merger or selling your company, there's a lot at stake besides your finances. There is the future value of your current investment, financial freedom, integrity, and overall reputation. If you need this kind of assistance, Sandra LaFlamme is a real estate expert with the experience, reputation, and knowledge qualified to assist you in all your key transactions. Sandra LaFlamme, real estate services with integrity and conscience. Contact her today at 888-366-8070. That's Sandra LaFlamme at 888-366-8070.
Welcome back to Threshold. This is Kenneth Eid. I'm with our host, Johnny Bluestar.
Well,
we're talking about the Bill of Rights.
We got through the First Amendment a little bit. We could have spent about 4 or 5 hours on it, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Let me read this second one. Really a contentious one in a lot of ways, a debated one.
Yeah.
A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Mm-hmm. Now, as I have seen this interpreted, that this was basically designed to create the right of people in different states to have militias, maybe not just states, but to have armed groups of people who would basically protect themselves against the government in case there was a problem.
You got to remember when this was enacted, okay? This was enacted around the time of the right after the American Revolution, where we all, you know, the colonies bore arms against the government and basically had a bloody revolution and took over. So another thing that was really important during that period of time was something called states' rights. They didn't want to have a really strong federal government like we have now. They wanted the states to govern themselves. So the United States of America, the federal system, was basically a loosely organized group of states which were each supposed to be sovereign. So basically, they're each allowed to have their own little army.
Would you say the militia did refer to a militia for a state?
Yes.
Okay.
Because if you look at states' rights, that's what we're talking about.
So when you say the security of a free state, they're talking about one of the United States?
Yes.
Okay.
I believe. I mean, there's other interpretations. The way it's been interpreted is United States military is not allowed to patrol around the different states. The states are allowed to have their own, forms of protection. Now that's being diluted because we're moving toward a system where we can imagine the president declaring martial law and the army setting the boots down in all of our 50 states, in my opinion.
Well, we had sort of a test case, you know, in Texas and around that area, right? Not too long ago.
Yeah, I mean, we've had a test case in many areas.
Well, I mean, we had a large exercise with lots of people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, how do you think that bears on the right to bear arms?
The right to bear arms has been interpreted by the Supreme Court to be the right of any American resident to have an arm to protect themselves. And that's... seems to be one of the only amendments that's not been assaulted yet, but it looks like it's going to be assaulted because of the controversy over all of these mass shootings. I mean, it's so easy for someone to go and get themselves a machine gun, an AK-47 or whatever, and run into a crowd of people and shoot them all. This is something we can't allow to happen here. But it's going to impact on the Second Amendment, because there's a movement now to restrict firearms, and they're restricted in many other Western countries.
Yeah. So it is a kind of a dicey situation, because I think that many people in America feel they should have the right to have some kind of weapon like that.
Well, there's a big lobby in America called the National Rifle Association, and they have a great political power, and there's going to be litigation against any kind of gun control. Any. You can bet on that.
Well, I do think that, personally, that you can get too extreme about that. Certainly, I think they should be able to reasonably own reasonable weapons to defend themselves. And I think, back to the original meaning of this, to some extent, which it was to protect themselves against the government that gets out of line.
Exactly.
Not that a government has gotten out of line, but I don't know at what point it's reasonable to think that people would use those arms in that particular way. But certainly they have a right to protect themselves on an individual basis from any kind of illegal intrusion.
They do, but I would say that they don't have the right to protect themselves against the government with arms. I would say that that is definitely not a right anymore.
But it was the original right.
That was the original right. It's interesting to note that technology, you know, over 200 years ago, we're talking about, you know, muskets where you stuff the ball into the musket and put in the gunpowder and you know, fire something that you've basically got to be close to kill somebody with. But now you can get, you know, basically you can be your own little army. The technology was not there when this thing was written. It may have had a different impact.
Now, the Third Amendment is interesting too. And I'm not sure there's much problems with it so far, but you tell me. Mm-hmm. No soldier shall, in time of peace, be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in the manner prescribed by law. So, mm-hmm. Is that a problem?
Well, that's getting to what I was talking about before. Is not, you know, then there's an act. I'm not sure what the exact name is, but that's the idea that the military is not going to be, you know, in your back door. They're only going to be basically, you know, fighting a foreign enemy. Whether it's someone that's, you know, I mean, of course they're going to be in your back door if someone lands on the coast of California and decides to take over. But basically they don't want, I would say that it's probably not a problem now, but it could be a problem.
I think it seems to be, you know, in the time of, you know, leading to the American Revolution, I think they were actually living in people's houses to oversee them. Is that correct?
It was mainly, that's correct. But it's the main idea is we don't really have any conflict here where there's been reason to invoke the military to protect the country. So there's no reason to have the military out and about in your own state.
I mean,
it goes beyond, you know, having them in your house and quartered in your house, which was probably what they were originally looking at. But now the judicial interpretation is saying that we don't want the military marching down our streets. And in other countries, you see the military out all the time. You do in France, for example. They're at the airport. But you don't see the military in our states. You see the state police, basically. I mean, and I think that this is something that needs to be safeguarded.
That's right. I mean, I rarely see military. I mean, I do once in a while. You see some military vehicles, but
you've got the National Guard, for example. But remember what the National Guard is. The governor of your state can say, I'm calling in the National Guard because there's a crisis here and we need to, you know, safety and order. But the National Guard is a unit. I mean, basically a United States military institution. Even though it's, you know, invoked by the governor of the particular state, the National Guard is a basically U.S. military installation.
This is Johnny Blue Star. I've worked as a lyricist with Patricia Welsh for over 5 years, along with Russian composer Edgar Ahrens, a friend and colleague. Her ability as a singer is simply amazing. She brings a unique and dramatic flair to every song she sings. Over the next few months, we shall be releasing a number of these songs, part of an album called Hadley's Castle. Meanwhile, Patricia has been busy creating a super enjoyable collection of classic standards in an exciting 46-song, 3-CD collection.
Music for Great Entertaining introduces Cocktails, Dinner, and Dessert with Patricia Welsh. 3 hours of continuous music. 46 of the all-time classic standards, spanning decades of hit songs. Going to a friend's home for dinner? Cocktails, Dinner, and Dessert with Patricia also makes the perfect hostess gift. This 3-CD compilation is the perfect background music that sets just the right mood for any dinner party.
I'm crazy for feeling so lonely. There was a boy, a very strange, enchanted boy.
To purchase this album, just go to patriciawelsh.com/CD. That is patriciawelsh.com/CD. You won't be disappointed.
It is the 15th century. El Tesoro de Cielo, a Spanish treasure ship, sends a scouting expedition to a strange island. Golden statues surrounding them prove the enormity of their find. Suddenly, hordes of ghoulish creatures with scaly green flesh and skeletal wings descend upon them from the sky.
What do you think of this, Rufio?
These creatures are fragile, Captain. We could take them with our swords.
They seem supernatural. Who knows what powers they possess?
Fallen angels, weakened by their treason.
My God! Are you saying they're Nephilim, the devil's host?
I'm saying, whatever they are, we can take them. Do any of you cowards dare join me?
Up against sharp knife-like nails and hideous fangs, the men's swords rip into slimy green flesh. Though black blood pours copiously from their half-naked bodies, creatures miraculously persist. Can the crew survive this bloody, cursed battle?
Find out more by Googling The Thrice Born, a new sci-fi supernatural novel by Carlos Lopez Avery and Johnny Bluestar. Google with the words Carlos Johnny Kendall, The Thrice Born. That's Carlos Johnny Kendall, The Thrice Born.
New Galaxy Enterprises is a media company specializing in wide-ranging content like novels, nonfiction books, screenplays, commercial advertising, web content, etc. One of our most esteemed providers is illustrator Robert W. Zalo. I work on all my most important projects, like book covers, logos, web design elements, with Robert. As an illustrator, he worked on the Ignatz-nominated comic book, The Expert's Guide to Killing Things That Go Bump in the Night. His skills encompass advertising, magazine illustrations, gaming, comic books, TV production, and scenic painting. His clients include Comcast, Adelphia, Haven Talent, Forceworks, High Octane Theater, Star Creative Advertising. If you wish to contact Robert, go to johnnybluestar.com and let me know. That's johnnybluestar.com for artist, illustrator Robert Zalo, an essential component of all the work we do. Maybe he can help you too.
Now, this next amendment is, I think, I won't say it's the most important, in a way it isn't. Perhaps they're all equally important. But this one is sort of a linchpin, which is driving us into, I think, a state of dictatorship, police state. Mm-hmm. It's the right of the Fourth Amendment is the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. No warrant shall issue, but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched, and the persons or things to be seized. Oh, well, I guess they haven't been doing this, getting all those particulars down about every single person in the world, including foreign leaders, too. But anyway, this does apply to citizens of the United States.
Right, and also people who are actually on United States soil.
Well, and I think this is pretty egregiously violated, Ken.
It's been egregiously violated. It's also been whittled away by the Supreme Court for many, many years, with the exception of in the 60s, they had a decision called Katz versus United States, where it expanded the Fourth Amendment right to Fourth Amendment guarantee to an individual's right of privacy. So wherever this, in other words, this is a guarantee of an individual right that goes around with the individual, whether it's in your house, your papers or effects, as it originally was stated. If you are, for example, in the Katz case was a person who was in a telephone booth and who was recorded using a microphone attached outside the glass. And if you're in a telephone booth, which we don't have anymore, you go in, you close the door, and you have an expectation of privacy in that telephone booth. So if it's anywhere you have an expectation of privacy, and everyone in society realizes that that expectation of privacy is reasonable, then you have the Fourth Amendment guarantee attaches to you in that booth, and they can't search anything in it or listen to you. Same thing applies, although I said the court has whittled away at the rights. There was a recent case in the past couple years where the court said they can't, let's say you are arrested, for example, they need a warrant to be able to search your cell phone. That's because people keep their whole lives in their cell phone now. I mean, it's the key to everyone. I mean, it's got your phone list in there. Everything you used to put in your papers now is in your computers and also in your cell phones. So that right of privacy applies to your cell phone, no matter whether you're caught drunk driving or whatever. They can't go into it without a warrant.
Well, I think that the reality is that the government has really violated the law about privacy and has retrospectively tried to correct it legally. But there were many things that were done during the Bush administration, which basically were very secret and which allowed for very tight surveillance over people without a warrant.
The Bush administration denied people a lot of constitutionally guaranteed rights, like the right of privacy, the right to counsel, the prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment. I mean, the Bush administration pretty much went down the Bill of Rights and just ignored all of them. And not only did they ignore them, they kept it secret. I like this quote from, if you ever heard this, can I tell you this quote from Glenn Greenwald, who is the one that he broke the Snowden case. He said, "The way things are supposed to work is that we're supposed to know virtually everything about what they, the government, do. That's why they're called public servants. They're supposed to know virtually nothing about what we do. That's why we're called private individuals."
And I think that's beautiful.
And that sums it up. That sums it up.
I don't know about you, although I'm not really, feeling like I'm being watched particularly. Mm-hmm. Ever since this started to happen, there's like been a shadow over my mind. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. I no longer feel like
free.
I did before.
You don't feel free. That's another thing Snowden said. He goes, there's studies out there that show that if you think or you know you're being watched, you're acting less free than you would otherwise act. So you're really not free.
There was another question that I had. It was about metadata. And it was about even going beyond metadata to content. Are they actually keeping records of all of our business correspondence, of our transactions in banks, things like that?
They are doing it with respect to, they have certain keywords that they're looking for. And if they zero in on one of those keywords, like, for example, terrorism. But terrorism is basically an excuse to screw with us, in my opinion. But they can go that far if you become a target of investigation. How you become a target is if you fit one of these key words.
But are they collecting the data of everybody? Are they collecting that data of business transactions of everybody in the United States right now?
Well, obviously that, I mean, they're looking at certain things. They're looking at people's emails and looking for those keywords, like I said. But they're not looking at everyone's, you're not looking at over 200 million people's bank records, no.
No, I'm not saying they're looking over them. I'm saying are they collecting them so they could look over them if they want to? And are they going that far in the surveillance?
I don't think so.
You're hard to do.
It would be very difficult to do, but what's very easy to do is the same thing that Google does, and that's basically look at all your internet contact, look at your Facebook, and I mean, they're doing that. They're doing that.
Isn't it currently illegal, supposedly, to go after individuals' content, not metadata?
Yes, it is. But that's a question of what you do with your content. If you put your content on Facebook, you're publishing it, basically. You're putting it out there on the internet for potentially millions of people to see, unless you mark it private.
Well, you know, I meant like emails, you know.
Oh, so. Emails, that's private content. And yes, they are going into emails. The government loves emails because now instead of having to call a witness that says he said this or she said that, people say it in writing, and they just grab your emails and they use it against people all the time. They love it.
I thought there was legislation that had eliminated that aspect of the surveillance.
Loosely eliminated it, but I think it's alive and well. I mean, the government's never stopped doing anything that they've been called on as being illegal, have they? I mean,
I don't know whether they have or not, but I don't know one person I've ever spoken to about something like this who believes the government has stopped.
I don't believe they've stopped.
So, I mean...
I don't believe they've stopped using torture.
No, I don't believe they've stopped either. It's just...
Just because there's a law against it doesn't mean they're not going to break it.
Well, they were breaking it
quite frequently. And I think they continued with the Bush administration, and they continued to defend, you know, we talked about Eric Holder last time, and they continue to support and defend these things that they're doing in the courts.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing.
Your shadow marks the brazen breeze. I sense you near and slowly
following is from West Side Warrior, the memoir of Ray Boylan, a Korean War veteran and crime fighter. He was there fighting in the world's coldest battlefield when the Chinese communists invaded.
Desperate squad members ran past our foxhole yelling, "Get the hell out of here! There's too many of them!" Again, we saw the Chinese soldiers charging in with opium-induced mindlessness, oblivious of our bullets. Again, we heard the bugles and whistles. Climbing out of our foxhole, Bob dropped two hand grenades behind us, and I threw one over my shoulder. Bullets whizzing by our heads, Bob and I became bolts of lightning flashing across the mountainside. Like a hideous film, desperate scenes like this played out on the Tokong Pass for 3 days. Sometimes I played in the scene. Sometimes I could only watch and wonder if it were real, or if I'd be suddenly jolted out of my trance by an RKO usher saying, "Hey, did you kids sneak in here?"
To acquire this book, Google westsidewarrior.boylan.kindle. Boylan is spelled B-O-Y-L-A-N. That's West Side Warrior, Boylan, Kindle.
I've worked with Russian composer Edgar Arin for quite a few years, building an inventory of songs, many of which feature singer-performer Patricia Welch. We will soon be releasing these songs, components of an album and a musical in progress called Hadley's Castle. When Edgar and I first got together, I was amazed by the brilliance of his musical scores created for movies, TVs, and animations. Here is a sample of the work he did on the Russian TV series, available now on Amazon, called The Secret Agent's Memoir, which had 2 seasons. This score is called Escape and was created for the first season. I am very pleased to say that Bridge of Light Productions, a division of New Galaxy Enterprises, is proud to be the contact point for television and film companies seeking information about this amazing composer's work. If you're in the entertainment business and wish to know more, contact me at johnnybluestar@gmail.com. That's johnnybluestar@gmail.com.
Getting to Amendment 5, no person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment or indictment of a grand jury, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia, or in actual service in time of war or public danger. Nor shall any person be subjected to the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb, nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa.
There's a lot of guarantees there.
Yeah, there's a lot of guarantees. And of course, since there's a, quote, war and terror, a lot of this has been tried to be totally vitiated, right?
Yes. I mean, the Fifth Amendment privilege is something they've always been trying to whittle away. You know, there's a Fifth Amendment privilege not to incriminate yourself, but then if they can go in and violate the Fourth Amendment and find documents where it incriminates you, they can use those documents. So, I mean, it's something that you basically is only the right not to incriminate yourself out of your own mouth. And right now with the federal government, with the kind of power that they have, it really doesn't mean that much, because if a prosecutor decides he's going to prosecute you for something, you're going to be prosecuted, and you have no money to defend yourself the way they have resources. Prosecutor has so much power that, you know, you basically bend over and kiss your ass goodbye. You have to make a deal with them. That's why 97% of federal cases are plea bargained. 97%.
Because they offer them an alternative. Either they get some kind of moderate sentence, or they're in jail forever.
Well, yeah, basically they're gonna take a minor participant or someone on the fringe of something, who shouldn't go to jail at all, and say, look, you're going to be, you know, the mastermind of this deal is doing 20 years in prison, and that's what you're going to do. But we'll give you two. Take it or leave it, you know, basically.
So you probably have a lot of innocent people.
I think you have. I mean, Judge Rakoff, New York federal judge, wrote an article. Why do innocent people go to prison? And he actually exposed this in public as being the way things are. He said the federal prosecutors have too much power. They've taken the idea of the founding fathers was everyone is supposed to have a jury trial. So the government, if they have an offense to prove against you, they really have to prove it. And now they don't have to do that anymore. That goes to this Fifth Amendment right of indictment by a grand jury. It's a joke. Jillian Hoffman, one of my fellow legal thriller writers, I read in one of her books a sentence that said that the government could indict a ham sandwich for anything they want, which is true. I mean, the grand jury is just a bunch of people who sit there and get read a speech by a federal prosecutor, and they vote whatever he says. That's the way it is now. It's a joke.
Well, if we want to get into even more, perhaps, sadly laughable matter, how about Amendment 6? In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district where the crime shall have been committed, which district shall have previously been ascertained by law, and to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation, to be confronted with witnesses against him, to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense.
Right. There's a lot of rights there as well. I mean, there's a lot of guarantees.
All thrown out the
there.
Window if you're, accused of some kind of terrorist activity, correct?
Terrorist activity, yeah. I mean, you're basically, you're out of all of those rights. They can just throw you in federal facility like Guantanamo and throw away the key. But there has been a lot of evolution with regard to what the Bush administration used to be able to do and what the Obama administration is allowed to do now. And basically, through case law, which takes a long time to come to fruition, they have said you can't grab someone as a suspected terrorist in the United States without affording them these Sixth Amendment rights. You just can't do it. But this is something that they've been doing outside the United States, and this is the reason why Guantanamo was selected as the terrorist prison, because anyone who's accused as a terrorist outside the United States is going to be thrown into a prison that the United States controls, but it's outside of the United States, even though it's a naval base that's completely controlled by the United States, which I think is a crock.
Yeah, well, particularly since of all the violations of human rights that have occurred there, as well as probably in all these black sites throughout the world.
Absolutely. I mean, I wrote a book on that as well, which you've read. It's called The Patriots Act.
Yeah. I wrote a book about an attorney who actually, you know, had somebody in Guantanamo too as a client. The mm-hmm. things that they did, they're actually disgusting. I mean, disgusting, like having a woman come in and do things to this prisoner that were completely against his religion. I mean, disgusting.
Oh, the government, that's the whole Abu Ghraib thing. I mean, they did that in Guantanamo. It's there's a expose that's been written by a friend of mine who actually witnessed the aftermath of a murder at Guantanamo Bay. And they violate the Sixth Amendment regularly there. If you're talking about an attorney who is representing a Guantanamo client, they monitor their conversations. They listen.
Yeah, I know. That's incredible.
It's ridiculous. And, you know, this is something that these private prisons have been criticized for, you know, possible eavesdropping on people's telephone calls, which is outrageous. I mean, it's crazy.
Especially with an attorney.
Exactly.
Yeah, I don't know. It's really, even though I've been steeped in this for so long, it's still... Why would people in the United States who grew up with these kind of laws be so eager and so meticulous to destroy them?
I don't think that, you know, if you're talking about individual actors, I don't think that they're...
I'm really talking about policymakers who are also
policymakers,
United States citizens.
Yeah.
But they're also United States citizens, and they're completely destroying the sort of the cream of the Constitution. And it's just, I mean...
I think that they're so powerful, Johnny, that they think they're above the law anyway. So none of this applies to them.
Yeah.
This is just the common people's rights, and who cares about that?
Right. Sad.
It is sad. And this, you know, whole Sixth Amendment thing about the jury trial, something I was talking about before, this is what the founding fathers had in mind. When you're accused of a crime, you're supposed to have a jury trial. Now, if you want to have a jury trial, you're already in jail. You have no right to basically gather your own evidence. If you don't have a couple $100,000, then you don't really have the right to defend yourself, because you're stuck with the public defender who's going to plea bargain you. And so you don't get a right to a jury trial. Like I said before, 97% of federal cases, you don't have a jury trial. And in something like 85% of state cases, you don't have a jury trial. So this is something that doesn't really exist anymore unless you're rich enough to get yourself out on bail and sometimes is impossible, and hire an attorney, which we are very expensive.
And also it seems like if you're a terrorist, then you're deprived even of, you're deprived of an attorney, or you're deprived of habeas corpus.
Suspected terrorist.
Suspected, okay. So you have no legal rights, but you would think that if people were seriously trying to, you know, deal with terrorism and an egregious crime, which is like a capital crime, it's a very serious crime, and it sometimes results in that, often, you would think they would want to meticulously know, is this guy really did it? But instead, they make it impossible to really investigate this situation in any kind of fair way at all.
It's correct, and with regard to the Fifth Amendment, they basically will force a confession out of somebody and get them to admit to something that they didn't do. And once that's done, the whole book is sealed on that particular case. So they don't really care. They've decided already. It's like the enemy of the people in the Soviet Union. If you were accused of being an enemy of the people, that means you're against the Communist Party, right? You're going to a gulag.
Well, so, another point here that has bothered me, I kind of studied cult programming for a while, C-U-L-T. Mm-hmm. And it's that these techniques that are being used were the same techniques used by the Chinese communists during the Korean War, which were basically to get people to make false confessions.
Yes.
And that really struck me as a strange component of this whole thing. Why would they choose these techniques that were used to get false confessions? Well, maybe that's what they wanted.
I think that once they decided that somebody's a terrorist, then, I mean, it's just a foregone conclusion. And basically, they just want to speed up the execution of that particular person who's the accused terrorist. They don't want to have a fact-finding process, like you said. They don't want to have a trial. They just want to have an execution. And that's why they decided to do it in somewhere outside the United States, where the courts wouldn't have any control over it.
Well, I'm actually implying something also in addition to that, which is that if you want to have the proof that there's a major problem in a certain area for certain reasons, so you get all these confessions, and it's kind of a gigantic PR component. You know, we've got these terrible people in Afghanistan, or
it's a huge PR component, and it's, you know, it's like these drone strikes where they say we killed the 30th in line leader of Al Qaeda, and you know, we blew up a hospital next door, but it was collateral damage. It's a PR campaign. We killed Osama bin Laden. That's a huge PR. We killed Saddam Hussein. It was a huge PR. So killing terrorists And showing the people that the government's doing their job is more important than really finding out what's going on.